This is the Canadian Foreign Policy Hour, which is a weekly critical look at Canada's role abroad. I think we're on about the 175th, 176th weekly episode of just kind of looking at what Canada's doing abroad. I'm coming to you from Jaujage, which has long been a meeting place of various First Nations, otherwise known as Montreal. And it is very, very, very hot here. I think they said it's like 33, 34 before the humidity. So it's towards 40. I saw something maybe even as high as 45 with the Humidex. On that note, there was a report published in the Le Devoir this week about Canadian banks financing fossil fuels. And a report called Banking on Climate Chaos that's had the Bank of Montreal as the eighth biggest financer of fossil fuel projects, $34.3 billion. The other Canadian banks were in ninth, TD, Scotiabank 13, CIBC 14, and BMO 16th. That's in the world. So Canadian, again, this is more confirmation that Canadian banks are among the biggest financers of fossil fuel projects, which is in part because Canadian banks are big players globally, and because Canada is a major producer of fossil fuels, the tar sands and whatnot. And of course, Canada has been a major outsized contributor to the climate crisis, certainly on a per capita basis by large margins compared to many countries in the world. There's a story in the Financial Post, I believe. Canadian business group pushes pipeline expansion in Mexico. So Canadian capital has been big players in pipelines in Mexico, I think particularly natural gas pipelines, but they are pushing expansion of the pipeline network. And it's been controversial, I don't think just from a climate standpoint, but from a nationalist resource standpoint. Obviously, Mexico has a long history of public ownership in the oil sector, and that was undermined or weakened by previous governments in the sort of 2000s. And mid 2010s, and the current government is kind of reversed some of that stuff, but Canadian pipeline companies continue to be major players there. The New York Times had a story this week about the drones. It was like a full page story, lots of photos about drone use by the police in Haiti. And we've talked about this previously. But according to this New York Times story, it's the RCMP that's donated the drones and surveillance drones and train and has trained the Haitian police on their use. But this story quotes the RCMP spokesperson basically saying that this sort of a unit of the police that's been created that's using drones to fight gangs, that this is illegal. This is the RCMP spokesperson saying this, and the RCMP does not, quote, does not condone the use of drones to carry munitions or as offensive tools. So the Canadian RCMP, which has been heavily involved with the Haitian police, which is behind this drone, these drones to a certain extent, is I'm very they're saying they're uncomfortable with how they're now being used against the gangs. This is just a sign of the incredible deterioration of conditions in Haiti, where drones are now being used to fight gangs, offensive drones. I think they're assassinating some people, and because the gangs have so much sway in Port-au-Prince, it's not a good scene. It's hard to see the way out. We know the way in to this problem in Haiti. We know how Canada has contributed to the deterioration in Haiti, but how do we get out? How we get out is a complicated issue. The BC Premier, Eby, the NDP Premier, is calling on Ottawa to label an Indian gang, the Bishnoi gang, as terrorists. Apparently, this gang which is got, I guess, people here, but they're also in India. They are extorting businesses, or I guess mostly businesses, but others within the Indian community, Sikh community, in the Vancouver area, or in BC more generally. And so the premier's calling for this gang to be put on the terrorist list. That makes me very uncomfortable. I think the terrorist list is not a tool, which is something we want to get rid of. This is a post 9/11 creation. And the idea that premiers are getting into the state where it's like there's a problem, and I think it's probably, this is some, I believe this is a problem that does need to be dealt with in terms of, people being extorted, and within the South Asian community, and I'm prepared to believe that this gang is doing that, and but to then go to the next step of you just going to start throwing a group that's involved in some criminal activity onto a terrorist list because that will supposedly facilitate, dealing with the criminal activity. I think this is a dangerous pathway. We've clearly already put way too many groups. First of all, a list shouldn't exist. There's no due process. It's just the state putting it on. It's hyper politicized, and going one each added group being put on legitimates the list, and I think is definitely the wrong direction. And it, quite frankly, it has significant kind of foreign policy implications. The Globe had a piece on a Thursday, a front page piece about the G7, maybe it was Wednesday, about how asking Carney about whether he raised the killing of Nijjar Singh with Modi when he met him at the G7, and apparently Carney didn't really respond, so presumably he didn't raise the issue, which doesn't surprise me all that much. A lot of criticism this week, continued criticism about the invitation to Modi to the G7. It's a tricky one. As I said previously, I wouldn't have invited him, but at the end of the day, this is the most populous country in the world. And what makes the G7 illegitimate in large part is that it's represents this, select seven who actually represent about 10% of the world population and try to drive, the global agenda, even though it's, a small minority of the world's population. And so inviting Modi in a sense democratizes the G7. So, anyways, it's not an easy decision, but it's I think it's not a straightforward dynamic in terms of the fact that he should or should not have been invited. And I don't want to in any way suggest that Carney's didn't invite Modi because he believes in, democratization of the G7. He did it because India is viewed as a potential ally in competition with China, because India represents economic opportunity, and the like. There's a story, a big controversy over, and I haven't followed that closely, just sort of reading the headlines, about how BC Ferries purchased some ferries from China, and they're making a big, huge kerfuffle about this purchase, which is all part of this anti-China question. Gary Mason had a piece in the column in the Globe Mail, kind of pushing back on it, and I agree. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the idea of, a notion that a public company would purchase their ferries from, within BC. I think that makes sense, and to keep the jobs there and whatnot. But apparently that wasn't really an option The shipyard is actually all booked up. The one in Vancouver, so this whole controversy just kind of fits into this kind of anti-China direction. Now, in the Globe this week, there was a piece in the piece about Carney not raising the assassination of Nijjar with Modi. Bob Fife or Robert Fife, the China hawk, he refers to Jenny Kwan, who's the NDP MP. He re refers to Jenny Kwan. He says NDP MP Jenny Kwan, an outspoken human rights activist. Okay, so this NDP MP is considered an outspoken human rights activist. Now, anyone who follows the NDP knows that Jenny Kwan sorry, just 2 seconds. I'm seeing slow operations here on my computer. So people might be we'll try to shut some things down. Are people able to hear me? I'm gonna turn the video off for a bit, maybe to see if that helps with people being able to hear me. I'm not sure. I turned the video off. Maybe I'll turn it back on a second. My Wi-Fi seems to be slow, or computer problems, or something. It's not clear to me. So I hope everyone can hear me. But anyway, so Robert Fife refers to Jenny Kwan as an outspoken human rights activist. But Jenny Kwan is not known. I mean, she's like been very, very non-active on Palestine. She's not noted as a particularly prominent sort of person on human rights. And the most important issue, at least, which far and away is the most important issue right now, is Gaza. But what she is at is the hawk within the NDP on China. And so, what happens to you in the Globe and Mail, specifically Robert Fife, if you are a hawk on China, then you get described just without like nothing. It's just in sort of just thrown in there in this glowing light. NDP MP Jenny Kwan, an outspoken human rights activist. And it just, I think it kind of, it's important to understand how these sort of really subtle kind of dynamics, like why would she be, I mean, literally, if you were to come up with the MPs that have been most active on Palestine, Jenny Kwan would be probably at the bottom of the list of NDP MPs. Maybe not right at the bottom, but pretty close to it. And I saw her in Ottawa 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I asked her about that World Bank report about China bringing 800 million people out of poverty. And she said she hadn't even heard of it, right? And like, so here you have someone who's this big hawk on China. She's really like all over the China file, but she literally hadn't heard what may be what was one of the greatest successes in dealing with extreme poverty in the history of humanity. You can again, you can criticize the Chinese government for this or that, but like this is World Bank data saying this, and Jenny Kwan like literally didn't even know about it, let alone like and she and when I brought it, said, well, she basically denied she wouldn't trust me that it was real, and so this is the level, quite honestly, of political sort of thought on this. The fact that the China hawk in the NDP, who gets described in this glowing way by the Globe and Mail, she's not even knowledgeable about pretty basic things with regards to China that contradict her narrative, of course, right? That contradict the official narrative, which don't get reported on in our media if they contradict the narrative. The Wall Street Journal reported that for the G7 summit, that Canadians had come to the summit holding an offer for a deal that would have exchanged higher Canadian military spending for the lifting of 50% US duties on steel and aluminum imports and levies on Canadian auto parts that have squeezed the industry here, said a Canadian official. So it's really that crass. That the Carney government is saying we'll increase military spending, telling Trump administration we'll increase military spending if you do this and that on your trade war. Today the government is joining this again. I'm going to maybe put my video off again. It seems to be slow. The Canadian government is joining this European Defense and Security Partnership that is big. Seems like what it's going to be about in part is that Canadian companies are going to have to have greater ability to supply European countries, and conversely, Canada is going to purchase more equipment from European military suppliers, and then there's going to be some element of a sort of security. This is sort of happening kind of in parallel to NATO. It's a little bit that Trump has sort of undercut NATO, and so we need to do this kind of dynamic. There was a big arms fair in Paris, and Legault, the premier of Quebec, was there supporting Bombardier, the big Montreal aerospace firm. Then Carney's going to go to the NATO summit, and according to Politico this morning, Carney makes way for the NATO Leaders Summit, where he'll briefly bask in the success of committing the 2% of GDP target. Then Politico goes on. Politico reports that NATO allies have reached a deal on the new 5% of gross domestic product on the military, and it will be confirmed at the summit beginning tomorrow. Apparently, Spain is holding out. It's a little unclear to me the details. Obviously, the Canadian government could join Spain. Spain seems to be the only country that's openly saying this is not doable, this is horrible, to massively increase Canadian military spending. This would be about $100 billion increase on the already $60 billion. That's a doubling over the past decade. The tie-in this week, and we're talking about major cuts to social programs that are coming from this. There's no way around this. We've talked about this in previous episodes. The Tie this week, this is a supposedly left-wing publication in Vancouver, in BC, and it had a piece by this Crawford Killian. And I should say, I emailed Crawford right after reading this, asked him if he wanted to do an interview about it, and he declined, which is, in my opinion, all kind of embarrassing. But basically, he wants to hit the 5%. He's calling for hitting the 5%. And the title of the Tai piece is The Case for Boosting Canada's Military Spending. And he says if Carney can boost military spending to 5% or higher by 2030, he will have achieved a great deal and hopefully help deter Russian aggression that would require four or five times that much spending. So if we don't hit the 5%, then Russia's going to invade, and then we're going to have to spend 20%, is essentially what he's saying. This is all completely bananas, like totally utter bananas. And this is what a supposed left-wing publication is writing. And I wrote a piece in response to Crawford's article, and I basically made the point that this is just the culmination of the Tai suppressing perspectives that contradict Washington's geopolitical outlook. And so I personally I've submitted pieces to the Tai around the NATO proxy war that they refused to publish. I wrote a response to one of their pieces they published. My father, who worked with David Beers when he at the Vancouver Sun, David Beers is the publisher of the Tyee. He submitted a piece contradicting the official line slightly, very mainstreamy kind of not a hard line piece from my dad. Just after the Russian invasion, and the Tyee refused to publish, but simultaneously they published just an endless stream of like hyper simplistic echoing of the official line. Russia, all bad. It's all just simple. It's all the bad Putin. They even blame Russia for the trucker convoy. They published a piece that just like anti-Russia sort of conspiracy theories. And the logical conclusion of all that is we have to follow NATO and massively cut social programs. And Crawford is basically saying that in his piece. Well, we just have to, the climate crisis. Yeah, the Tyee focuses a lot on the climate. He's like, yeah, the climate crisis is serious, but well, we got to put a bunch of money into the military. That's more serious, essentially. So it's just remarkable to see. It reflects a the narrowness of the geopolitical debate in this country. There is whoever Washington decides are the official enemies are the official enemies, and almost everyone falls into line. Like it's remarkable. Even if you look at a map, right? You say like, is Russia going to invade? Okay, well, the idea of them invading from the Arctic is a joke, right? It's a joke, as Arctic specialists say, it would be a large search and rescue mission. That's what it would lead to. And Canada has troops on Russia's borders, had them there for 8 years. Canada has troops in Latvia leading a NATO mission there, about 2,000 Canadians. I think it's a 4,000 member NATO force, and NATO has troops all across the Russia's western border. Looking at a map, it's not Russia that's the geopolitical aggressor, it's the NATO bloc. Now, that doesn't excuse what Russia's done in Ukraine, but that's the reality. That is a provoked war. We have played a central role in provoking it. We've been the belligerent force, meaning NATO, the US, NATO, vis-a-vis Russia. Now, Russia has done something violent in response that I don't think is justifiable, but there is a context. And that context is just it's not allowed. You're just simply not allowed to hear it in 95% of 98%, 99% of Canadian publications, including left-wing publications, who now believe we need to increase military spending by $100 billion on top of the $60 billion, the major increases that have brought us to $60 billion in recent years, which is going to lead to massive attack on social entitlements. But that's where the left is at. I'm gonna try this video one more time. The shifting gears, there's a Harvard report, apparently based on IDF, IOF data about residents in Gaza. And they're saying that 377,000 people have disappeared in Gaza out of a population of 2.27. This is apparently based again on Israeli military data. Some Israeli academic got access to this. I don't know the reliability of this information. I saw it circulating on social media and I looked into it, and I've seen one article that talks about it. It's not, but this is a, I think everyone agrees, anyone serious agrees that the 60,000 number official is wildly underestimated. The Lancet said quite a while ago it was probably about 186,000. That's 6, 8, 10 months ago. So I think that the notion of 200,000 plus seems probably kind of minimum area, but this is saying much higher. This would put it towards, I think, 16 or 17% of the population that's been killed in the past 20 months in Gaza. That's a very, very remarkable proportion of the population. And I think, unfortunately, probably closer to truth than what we're hearing. This week, despite the horrors, despite more horrors, these like the Hunger Games, assassinations of Iranian or of Palestinians trying to get food. I think it's like 400 have been assassinated trying to get food over the past week. Just horrible, horrible stuff. getting less and less attention because of what's happening with Iran. But despite that, there's an assault against those opposing it. Dahlia Kurtz, I don't know the full background because I blocked her a while ago, but someone tweeted tied me to this tweet, and she's boasting about getting what she calls the keffiyeh paramedic fired, some paramedic that wears a keffiyeh. Toronto High School yearbook, the principal covered up photos of students wearing keffiyehs. They covered up the photos of kids. This is the students that wore keffiyehs. They covered a whole bunch of them. They initially said it's a misprint, and then admitted that it was didn't want to politicize the high school yearbook. Remarkable stuff. In Pitt Meadows, a suburb of Vancouver, there was a guy, an Alberta guy, attacks at a gas station early in the morning. Attacks a guy, hits him a couple times, knocks him over for having a Free Palestine sticker on his vehicle. In a protest, so we're seeing, more of this fallout of this repression. Those who oppose the killing of 400. Sorry, everyone. I don't know what's happening. The either my computer's got some problems or the Wi-Fi is not working very well. I cut most everything. I think I realized when I cut out. Allison Haynes in the Montreal Gazette. She's this liberal columnist. She's talked about when Greta Thunberg was here. She's really pro Greta Thunberg. Pro Amnesty International. She doesn't cite Greta on the Palestine stuff and doesn't cite Amnesty on the Palestine stuff. So you see it. You see this dynamic where she's this liberal, whatever. Now, the point that I want to make, and it's this big long piece, huge piece she had in the Gazette on I think Thursday, Friday. I'm not sure. Sometime this week. Is that of how liberal journalists, when it comes to Israel, they don't just go, they don't just refuse to cover Amnesty and Greta's position on Palestine, but they go down the path of like the right, like racist right. And she has this big piece, and it's interesting what drives this too. So it's a big piece about the Genocide Foundation here in Montreal. Genocide Education Foundation. This person who's been on my radar for a while. It's a Holocaust industry, right? She's uses the Nazi Holocaust as part of a pro-Israel kind of whatever. I've been aware of this for a while. Now, Allison Haynes has this big long piece, front page, about this organization and how they post amidst the Israel's genocide, their allies are like backing away from them, and it's harder and harder for them to operate because they don't get people don't want to be associated with them because they basically support the genocide in Gaza. Which, of course, if you consider yourself a genocide education foundation, there's nothing worse than supporting an ongoing genocide. Like, historic genocide's good. Yeah, let's talk about them, but like, they happened already. We need to go forward, and we just stop those going forward. Obviously, far, 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 far more important than having the proper analysis of a historic genocide. Okay, that's very obvious for anyone who thinks about it for 5 seconds, but it seems to be lost in our media. But in this piece, Allison Haynes writes this. It's some bunch of stuff that's quite interesting, framed from horrible this is. It's not even this policy. Arab parents and school children pushing back against their Holocaust initiative efforts in school. She's showing them a little bit of what Israel doing. Fascinating. She gets herself completely confused about the International Criminal Court and International Court of Justice. She just melts all of the same things. So she's showing how little knowledge she has about what's actually going on. She tried to pour up in the critical law piece. Focus on forces in history, semi-existing testimony. Part of the fascinating about the war. And Trump has now not just gone on, he's gone into open racism. Like he's was all the he's taking a complete opposite kind of thing. He's promoting from this notion of industry council. Very sorry, everyone. I'm not sure what's going on here, but I want to finish my point with Allison Haynes. She takes her whole framing, her whole pro-genocide is framed through the angle of the Holocaust industry. You know the horrors of what happened to European Jewry and the rise of anti-Semitism, injustice that's happened over the past 20 months, and so it really fits her liberal disposition. So she's aligning with power, power in the sense of US empire power, power in the sense of the Israel lobby power, but all framed from a human rightsy kind of angle. But in her trajectory, she's moving further and further down the pathway as a whole bunch of non-Jewish liberal types have in their they've moved down the pathway of like getting towards pretty openly racist, anti-multicultural kind of trajectory, and it's Israel is right at the center of a whole bunch of this. Because of my Wi-Fi so bad and I'm nervous it's gonna go out again, I think I'm just gonna skip to the final kind of issue I want to talk about, which is the Iran question. Which is obviously the most important question happening right now. And it's been remarkable. Donald Trump drops 14 of these bunker busters, dozens and dozens of Tomahawk missiles. Iran just responded a couple hours ago with the US base in Qatar. Presumably Iran is trying to basically de-escalate with this what was a announced attack. They told the Qataris that this was coming, and no one killed, no sort of minimal damage. I think it's Qatar's trying or Iran's trying to demonstrate that they can hit these bases. We know where they are. We have the whatever. And if you do something else, we next time we'll actually kill people or try to kill people or whatever. But it's almost certainly an effort to de-escalate by Iran. Iran, of course, wants to just, they want it to be them. And if it's going to keep going, they want it to be them and Israel. Simultaneously, of course, Netanyahu has been trying to do everything to possibly to bring the US and Trump into this. That's the simple thing. Now, the big picture, I think, that is, it just needs to be stated. This is just about hegemony. This is about Israel. There's a quote that the Globe had, I think on Thursday, fairly decent. I think it's this article about regime change, and he's quoting Macron, and Emmanuel Macron, the French president. That Unlike the vast majority of countries in the world, where maybe you don't want a powerful, maybe France. Apologies, everyone. I don't know what's going on. Apologies, really too bad. But Israel's wants weakness. That's what they want around them. The response to Trump. The Iranian people are confronted without. Okay, Donald Trump, 9 days of Israel's bombing, active aggression, Donald Trump drops a whole small on Iran. Response in Canada is Canada's fading without. Okay. Now, Canada has, are we talking about how Mark Carney, you ask Mark Carney, Carney is pursuing policies to great work to pass indigenous rights and other, is that going to follow means without? This is something in Canada. Letting publication is to publish this kind of thing in to thrash, like of aggression. And in this piece, he refers to campists right at the top, campus. He doesn't mention Canada. You're writing for a Canadian audience. You're sitting in Canada. Amir Kadir, who's a politician, of course, of Iranian descent, he doesn't. He represents far and away by like a margin of 100, the important camp Canadians deal with, which is the Canadian camp. Our government national out the window. Our minister ignoring international law, granting this violation has been a form of aggression, and even mentioned Canada in peace. It's a dark position in Canadian left wing. So this kind of, I guess the final thing I'll say, and I'm really do about this spark connected computers. This whole business. So in Carney's statement is the nuclear, right? The framing and this propaganda nuclear stuff. Now, obviously, it's JCPOA or grand, right? Concerned about trying to get nuclear weapon, and yet this is the propaganda line. So the Canadian government, the hypocrisy is just off the chart. But taking it a little bit seriously, clearly was opinion. We're brought into many wars.
Of course, because why shouldn't they have nuclear capability? Why shouldn't everybody have nuclear capability? The facts are, the way it works is that you try to be the biggest guy and then get other countries with you on your side. And then what it comes to is world war eventually. So it's not really any better than each country having their own nuclear weapons. And also, it's a huge distraction because Iran shouldn't have to argue that they want nuclear power. You know, I mean, we could dump solar energy on them and defeat that argument right away. But we don't. Because we're a hegemon and we want to take them out. Only problem is, then they'll come and take us out. And they're bigger than us because it's Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran against us, and we haven't got a prayer. That's my view.
Yeah, I just got back on. I didn't hear the full thing. I don't think that Russia and China are going to get involved. I think there is this very small chance that I think for Iran, what they want to do here is, to the extent they can, make it just they want to get obviously the U.S. out, and if they're going to keep with this going, they want it to make it the Israel, Iran. They want to isolate it in that way. And
But
obviously,
this is different now, Eve, because this is the whole world against Israel now. This has never been the case before.
I'm skeptical of that. I don't think that the whole, I think the whole world is hostile to Israel. I think the whole world is, you saw that stuff about how the South Korean leader and the Japanese leader are not going to the NATO summit because, and this is, these are one of them is a G7 member, and these are, real U.S. allies. They're not going to the NATO summit apparently because they don't want to be kind of associated with Israel or the U.S. and Israel's attacks on Iran, and this NATO summit's going to be heavily focused on that. And I guess there's so much opposition domestically and stuff like that. So I think world opinion is clearly, world opinion is with Iran, but that world opinion is not, what people in Uganda think about Israel or the U.S. doesn't matter much when it comes to war, and nor does even what people in Russia think or what people in China think. The likely scenario, I think there are scenarios where China could offer some support, and obviously China has some major interests in Iran, and so does Russia has some interests as well. But they ultimately don't. They don't want to get themselves into a more of a direct fight with the U.S. or Israel, especially since it looks like we'll see how this goes. But it looks like Israel has done. They've had successes, right? They're getting hit pretty hard. Iran is clearly hitting Israel fairly hard, and maybe surprisingly so. I don't know enough about military affairs, but they clearly Iran is able to bypass the iron or the Iron Dome and the other interceptor Israeli stuff. But I don't. But Iran's also been hit pretty hard, and
Now, Qatar.
yeah. But Qatar thing was mostly just for show.
Well, it's.
Oh, sorry, Lynn. I didn't mean to meet you. I was unmuting Yuri, I thought. Go ahead, Lynn. Make your final point, please.
But Qatar, supporting Hamas through Israel, actually. It's like a confusing situation, and you could say that Israel planned not only the PLO and Fatah but Hamas too. Israel wants to control everything to do with Palestine.
Yeah, I think that's true.
There's no doubt about that. They don't just want to control it. They want to get rid of all the Palestinians, take all the rest of the land, West Bank and Gaza, and then start taking more and more in Syria and bordering in, greater Israel. That is ultimately where the Zionist movement would like to go. That's
Yeah, we're going to go to Yuri now, but just one thing I'd just like to say, when you talk about everyone being, against Israel, I think we have to distinguish between the people and the leaders. We certainly are not seeing that, unfortunately, amongst much of the leaders of the world, but we're seeing it amongst people. Okay, go ahead, Yuri.
Yeah, and I'll just also include to that, as much as I'll also just include that until China and Russia engage in full on BDS, I'm really not interested in whatever diplomatic statements they make, even if it criticizes Israel, because unless they actually engage in full on BDS, talk is cheap and actions speak louder than words. Eva. Yeah, two quick questions. Somebody wanted to ask about what you thought about Trump's threats of using nuclear weapons on Iran. I didn't see that. And do you think there's a bit of a split in the anti-war movement? Because I see a lot of people, particularly folks of an Iranian background, who say a version of, well, I don't like what the West is doing, and I don't like what Israel's doing, but I don't like the Islamic Republic, and they kind of de facto are sort of saying that they actually don't mind the West and the US overthrowing the Islamic Republic of Iran and whatever. I mean, who gives a shit what I think about the Islamic Republic, but it's like Do we not ever learn that that's not how imperialism works and being and I yeah. So I'm frustrated with that. Curious your response.
Yeah, I mean, that was my point about Amir Kadir's piece and this Canadian Dimension's response to Donald Trump attacks is to publish something that's basically like that without anything about Canada. I mean, that's remarkable. That's you know, this is at the left fringe. And obviously they publish it partly because it's Amir Kadir and Amir Kadir is like prominent. But that's remarkable. I mean, it's remarkable. Like you're gonna take shots at campists amidst the. I mean, okay. If you're gonna have an assessment of the Iranian government, I don't know enough about Iran to know. I truly believe that it has a repressive history. I also believe that education rates of women are very high. They actually have invested money after the Iranian Revolution into the population, and you have very high levels of education among women. So, okay, you got to put on a table. I also believe, I've been told, and I believe this, that I don't know much about it, that they have quite bad ecological policy. Okay, so you have class divide within Iranian society that I don't like, though I don't think it's as extreme as it is in Canada. Anyways, you go through like the 100 most important issues of it. Every country you go, well, this, that, where you fall on the pendulum of is it, how bad is it ecologically, class issues, women's rights. You go over there, okay, put it all down on the table. But you also have to put on things like the fact that, okay, our government is backing a Holocaust, and that government, for whatever reason, and I do think the reason is not actually like an all bad reason, but for whatever reason, that government is providing some degree of opposition to that Holocaust. Now, they're prioritizing their own state interests. They're prioritizing their own political narrow interests above Palestinian interests. Of course they are, right? But Iran, the Iranian government, is clearly providing certainly far, 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 far more support to the Palestinians than Canada is. So you have to put that on the equation when you're like looking at what the Iranian government is in actual fact. So have your criticisms about different elements of the Iranian government, but basically what happens, what Iranian Canadians to a large extent do, and this is where Amir Kadir is, and this is where he, and I know Amir, and he's pro-Palestine. I see him at the McGill encampment, and he was at the event. He spoke at the event I was at, spoke at 3 weeks ago or whatever, a month ago, whatever. What they do is it's like they basically take the jumping off point, the demonization that's not based in fact. The demonization in our dominant media is a distortion. It's not reality. And we have to be able to accept it. That's not to say that like Iranian government is all good, but the distortion is way out of proportion. The fact that Canada doesn't have diplomatic relations, the fact that we've listed their military as a terrorist organization, the fact that we listed the country as a state sponsor of terror, while we haven't done that to Israel, we haven't done that to US, we haven't done that with Saudi Arabia, however you want to look, however you want, if you start, so it's that, and that's just concession. That's just concession. That's Canadian Dimensions conceding to the imperial ideological apparatus, right? And we don't need to accept that. That should be pushed back against aggressively. And the main point that always needs to be centered here is Canada's role. That has to be what we center here. And so when Amir Kadir also had a piece in The Breach, and I began writing a kind of response to it, which was basically, it was just basically the one point. It was a piece in The Breach a couple of days ago. It was a bit better than the piece in Canadian Mention. And he talks about the 53 coup, and he doesn't mention Canada, but he mentions Lester Pearson in this positive. He has a throwaway line about Lester Pearson, the great Lester Pearson. Well, Lester Pearson was the foreign minister that supported the coup in 1953. Right? And like Kadir clearly doesn't know that. And so you're writing for a Canadian audience. You're like you're framing yourself as the expert. And I no doubt Amir Kadir knows more about Iran than I do, by large margins. But on the subject in this case that matters most to the audience, he doesn't know. He doesn't know the actual history of Canada and Canadian foreign policy and the fact. So it's like, and that matters too. It's not just a kind of like, because part of this is at a fundamental level is some degree of a belief in Canada. But Amir Kadir publishing stuff like this and going along with the zeitgeist of Canadian media and political whatever is at some level, and he would obviously deny that vis-a-vis the US. He would understand the U.S. is belligerent, whatever. He would, that. But some part of this is a Canadian nationalist, a Canadian mythology element to it all, and how how he frames what the good and the bad of the Iranian government. When a country is attacked like that, and you're sitting in a country that's one of the assisters of that of these attacks. You do not spend your time talking about how they're facing two enemies, right? That's just not that is assisting imperialism.
Well, the only thing I know he didn't mean this way, but there certainly are enemies of the Iranian regime that are assisting Israel and Iran, as with all the drone attacks and things. I know he meant it in a totally different way, but there are two enemies in Iran within, which is the MEK and all those people. Eve, can I just ask you a quick question? It drives me crazy how people keep using the 55,000 figure or so for dead in Gaza when we know it's a massive undercount. But I'm just wondering, in conflicts, how do people usually, when they don't know the exact number, like, do they just throw out estimates? Or here they're only doing, the ones that the Hamas Health Ministry gives them that are verified dead. They can put a name to the person. But I mean, how is it usually reported in media during a
Well,
conflict?
that's the point. That was the kind of major point of the Lancet study that came out 10 months ago, 8 months ago, whatever, is that there's it's always a very small proportion of direct kills. Right? When we talk about the 4 million or 8 million or 6 million of different studies at different points killed in Eastern Congo, it's like 9 of 10 are people who didn't get access to medicine because of the instability, they didn't get access to food, children that died because they didn't get food, right? The direct kill, there's lots of direct kills, but it's always a small proportion of it. And that was the sort of central point of the Lancet study. The 186,000 number that Lancet put out there, it was basically saying that, like, okay, we look at other conflicts and what people have come to the estimates of kills, of deaths. And the way it's like everywhere between 3 to 1 to 10 to 1, and the 186,000 number, or I don't know, I just use those numbers 3 to 1 to 10 to 1, but like some it was a range, like fairly significant range, and the 186,000 number, my understanding was like at the low range where they were saying,
Well,
well.
yeah, see, that I know, but what I'm wondering though is another conflict. When they're reporting, like when the media reports on the number dead in Ukraine or whatever, how are they? Are they putting estimates of both direct and indirect deaths, or how is it? Is this an aberration? Where, I mean, how is it reported in media during these
Now,
conflicts?
the Ukraine is totally different in the
Well,
sense
I
that.
mean, any conflict, don't take Iran, any other conflict, how do they, what methodology do people, the newspapers, not use to report the number believed dead at any time?
Yeah, I mean that I don't know enough to know, but like basically they always cite some source, right? So in the case of where it's not hyper politicized, they'll cite I don't know, Human Rights Watch's estimate or whatever, right? Not necessarily Human Rights, probably not best example, but in the case of Ukraine, they just cite the Ukrainian government saying we've killed 500,000 Russian soldiers or whatever, right? Or they cite some like by U.S. military estimates or some variation of that. That's all kind of quite vague. So yeah, I guess I don't know enough, and it varies a bit from each depending on how politicized the conflict is in Canada. That varies in how they do that, but.
Okay, we have one last question from Catherine. Catherine, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
I was listening to Electronic Intifada discussion about the gangs, the collaborator gangs in Gaza. And it just reminded me so much of what, historically has happened in Haiti, and I'm not so up to date about the situation now, although I mean, it just seems like it's really awful, and but I know that there's been historical connections between some of the gangs and some of the fascist type leadership in Haiti. And I just thought it would be a really interesting discussion if Foreign Policy Hour wanted to do something at some time with two guests talking about the similarities and differences about those gang collaborator situations. Anyway, just a suggestion. And I also wanted to mention that I don't know if people heard about this. Now, this is in B'nai B'rith. Nova Scotia man arrested following B'nai B'rith Canada complaint, and his name is Luke Alexander McDonnell, 22. He will face charges of promoting genocide and inciting hatred. And B'nai B'rith included his post from, I don't know if it was on X or where, and it says, "I want to see all Zios killed. I want all Israelis murdered. Kill every Israeli. I want to see aircraft hijackings happen. Hang them by their neck." For anyway, it goes on. It's kind of awful, but it's just, these are the same New Glasgow police who threatened to arrest me if I didn't give my name and address for because I was passing out pamphlets about RBC's connections to genocide in Gaza and ecocide around, well, out west with the Coastal Gas Link, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, just wondering what people think, what you think about all of that, Eve.
Yeah, I mean, I think that B'nai B'rith loves the idea of getting, the police, like flipping it around. It's like the people who are, opposing Israel's crimes are the ones promoting genocide. They just love that. That's a huge kind of propaganda win. And the police, whether this person's statement is wrong or, right, and like how to exactly how do you kind of like process that? But yeah, B'nai B'rith's just on a total tear trying to find things like this, and whether this person is believes this, is whether they have any power, whether they are whatever, I who knows, but yeah, I think it's yeah, it's I'm big picture. It's all part of this flipping the world upside down, right? B'nai B'rith is the one that is promoting genocide, and the police are mostly doing the bidding of B'nai B'rith. The Toronto police, right away after when I think I talked about last week about after Israel's attack, the Toronto police immediately put out a protection warning, and then it did the same thing after Donald Trump attacks Iran, and the protection is, of course, it's for, right, it's for Jewish institutions, or more specifically pro-Israel Jewish institutions in Toronto. It's all the flipping things of upside down, but yeah, it's pretty remarkable to watch that as people get slaughtered for trying to get some food in Gaza.
I think that's it for questions, Eve. Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks everyone. Sorry again for the technical problems. Take care.
Bye.